This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
We should just do it tomorrow instead. Internet would be better. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Sorry about the slow start. We had some technical difficulties, internet, etc. But we have arrived to session 54A of our series. The 77th name, Al-Dhahir. But before starting, we will greet our students and visitors as usual, beginning with Sister Nadira Tajuddin from Melbourne, Australia. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Followed by Roshan Ali, wa alaikum salam, Ridwan Muhammad, and Rashida Abdul Rashid from Virginia, barakallahu fikum. Fathi Shaznin, wa alaikum salam, also from Melbourne, Australia. Zahid Asha, wa alaikum salam. Faisal Ali, wa alaikum salam. Yasmin Ismail, wa alaikum salam, from South Africa. Sadaf Ali, wa alaikum salam. Okay, with that brief greeting to our students, we'll now shift to our main program, session 54A. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, was salatu was salam ala Rasulihi al-Kareem, wa ala alihi wa ashabi, wa man istanna bi sunnatihi ila yawmiddin. All praise is due to Allah, and may Allah's peace and blessings be on the last Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and on all those who follow the path of righteousness until the last day. This is session 54A. That is part one. The 77th name, Al-Dhahir, that is the evident, the outer, the manifest. And this name, like the others before it, is mentioned only once in the Quran. Huwa al-awwal wal-akhir wal-dhahir wal-batin wa huwa bi kulli shay'in 'alim. He is the first and the last, the outer and the inner, and he has knowledge of all things. Surah Hadid, verse 3. Linguistically, al-dhahir comes from the triliteral root dha, ha, and ra. Dhahrun, dhuhur, is its verbal noun. It has five main meanings. The first meaning is to be visible, manifest, and distinct. The second meaning is to open, or to come out. The third is to ascend and to have a higher status. The fourth meaning is to subdue, to overcome. And the fifth is to help and to support others. This root appears some 59 times in the Quran, in 10 derived forms. Examples of these forms are Zahara is apparent, Yudahiruna, they turn their backs, Liyudhirahu, to make it prevail, and Zahrihi, its or his back. Zahir is the present participle in the fa'il intensive form pattern from Zahir. Al-Zahir is the most manifest, as everything other than him is only manifested by his attributes. He is high above his creation, and nothing is higher than him. This is the explanation given in Jami' al-Bayan, and it was chosen by an-Nahhas in his book I'rab al-Quran. Al-Zahir was explained by the Prophet ﷺ himself in his statement describing Allah, وَأَنْتَ الظَّاهِرُ فَلَيْسَ فَوْقَكَ شَيْءٍ, and you are the highest and there's nothing above you. He's also the one who subdues everything and everyone, while on the other hand, he is the true helper, while others can only provide help and support through his aid. Relative to Allah, being a Zahir is being the one who is above everything, yet manifest in all of the creation. His existence and oneness is apparent through all of the signs in the universe, yet he is not to be perceived by our senses in this world. According to Az-Zujjaj, he is manifest to the intellect by way of his evidences and proofs of his existence and affirmation of his unique unity. Moving on to the application, according to Ibn Battal's four principles. Principle number one is to adopt where applicable. The divine name of Zahir, the manifest, may be adopted by human beings and applied in their lives in three basic ways. The first is to be intellectually certain about Allah's existence at whatever level convinces us. The second is to understand that Allah's essence is not within his creation, but above and beyond creation. The third is to be convinced about the authenticity of the Quran, that it is in fact from God. So the first, we'll call it A. The first is proofs of Allah's existence from creation. Allah al-Zahir, the evident, promised to show his creatures from among humankind and the jinn enough signs, whether in nature around them or within themselves, to prove to them of his existence. The Almighty and the evident said, سَنُرِيهِمْ آيَاتِنَا فِي الْآفَاقِ وَفِي أَنفُسِهِمْ حَتَّى يَتَبَيَّنَ لَهُمْ أَنَّهُ الْحَقِّ. We will show them our signs in the universe and within themselves until it becomes clear to them that this Quran is the truth. Surah Fussilat, verse 53. Belief in God's existence. First and foremost, it should be noted that belief in God's existence is not illogical, as it is without evidence, while disbelief is logical, First and foremost, it should be noted that belief in God's existence is not illogical, as commonly said by modern atheists, because it doesn't have evidence. That's their claim. Whereas, as atheists, denying God's existence, that is more logical because there's no evidence for his existence. Leading ancient Greek philosophers like Plato, who died in 347 before the Christian era, and Aristotle, who died in 322 before the Christian era, intellectual giants whose thoughts are still studied today in universities of the East and the West, as the peak of intellectual rationality, both concluded that God must exist. Plato argued design indicates a designer, while Aristotle argued that the cause and effect chain of things, which could exist or not exist, must come to an end. The ancient Arabs used to allude to this idea of design in their proverb, "Camel's dung indicates the camel's presence." When human beings walking on a beach come across footprints in the sand, they immediately conclude that a human being had previously walked by there. That would be the first thought to come to their minds, and not the possibility that the waves of the sea settled in the sand and by chance produced prints looking exactly like human footprints. Similarly, if somebody was asked where he got his new table from, and he replied that yesterday, while he was in a forest at the bottom of a mountain, a tree fell on the side of the mountain near the top and splintered into 5 pieces of wood, one looking something like the top of a table and the other 4 looking like table legs. When the tree hit the ground and the 5 pieces began to roll and slide down the mountain, they dislodged some rocks and caused a rock slide. During the landslide, some of the rocks hit other rocks, and bits of iron came loose from the rocks as they rolled down the mountainside. The rolling rocks pounded the bits of iron into the shape of nails, so that when the landslide reached the bottom of the mountain, the nails were knocked through the wooden table legs by some of the rolling stones, and the table legs became stuck to the tabletop, and he found a complete table in front of him. He would be looked at as a madman. The table could not have been the product of such an accident. Common sense tells us that it was designed and made by a carpenter. But for the atheist, it is possible that this could happen accidentally. Consequently, it is not surprising to find that all human societies throughout human history, with very few exceptions, have believed in the existence of God. It is only in the 20th century that whole societies have become established based on the denial of God's existence, like Russia and China, states under their control also. Systematically, they taught atheism in all of their institutions of learning. However, after the fall of Russia, the Soviet system, and the abandonment of communist economics in both China and Russia, the resurgence of religion in both countries has been phenomenal. In Russia, it is even more so. Anthropologists and sociologists and psychologists have long held the belief that God and the belief in God was acquired by nature and not natural. This was a natural result of their Darwinian views, which considered humans essentially animals And thus, the absence of religion among apes indicated that it must be man-made. However, the Prophet ﷺ, 1,400 years ago, informed us that the belief in God was a part of the nature with which Allah created us. He said, "Ma min mauludin illa yuladu ala al-fitra, fa abawahu yuhawidani wa yunassirani wa yumajisani." Every child is born with a natural belief in God, Islam. It is his parents who makes him a Jew, a Christian, or a Magian. Just as animals give birth to young with their limbs perfect. Have you seen any deficiency in them? Abu Huraira then said, "Read if you wish the nature in which Allah has created people. Allah's creation cannot be altered. That is the right religion. Fitrat Allahi التي فطر الناس عليها لا تبديل لخلق الله ذلك الدين القيم." Surah Rum, verse 30. The father of psychiatry, Sigmund Freud, on the other hand, proposed that the Oedipal complex was the basis of human belief in God. And he fabricated a preposterous story to illustrate it. Oedipal complex is something which has been observed, you know, among children as they grow up from infancy, that they become jealous of the father and try to come between the father and the mother if they sit together and things like this. And in the story of Oedipus, it's an ancient Greek myth, you know, he kills his father and marries his mother. But of course, this is a ridiculous story, but as Sigmund Freud made a story out of this, that the first family that came out of living in caves and came out and they were living together, the father was the one going out and killing the animals, bringing the food, mothers at home cooking the food, tending the fields, whatever. Children get jealous of the father, so they kill him. Now, after he's died, he's no longer there to protect them from the animals, etc. So they make up a God in the sky, make up a father in the sky, father who is still looking over them, even though they killed him. And it's from that belief, it became instinctive in them to look up to the father to protect them. This is total nonsense. But anyway, that's Sigmund Freud's story. However, some modern researchers increasingly leaned to the conclusion that belief in God must be natural for it to be so widespread. But they were laughed out of conferences in which they presented their conclusions. But in 1997, experimental evidence for the inherent belief in God was found. Most of us never even heard about this. It appeared in the newspapers, and basically, we didn't hear too much more about it afterwards. There was an article written by Steve Connor, who was a science correspondent, which he titled, "God Spot is Found in the Brain." Scientists, he wrote, believe they have discovered a God module in the brain, which could be responsible for man's evolutionary instinct to believe in God. See, they're referring it, the belief in God, as being an evolutionary instinct. It's there, natural. A study of epileptics who are known to have profoundly spiritual experiences has located a circuit of nerves in the front of the brain, which appears to become naturally active when they think about God. The scientist said that although the research and its conclusions are preliminary, initial results suggest that the phenomenon of religious belief is hardwired into the brain. Epileptic patients who suffer from seizures of the brain, of the frontal lobe of the brain, said they frequently experience intense mystical episodes and often become obsessed with religious spirituality. So, of course, to deal with that, evolutionary scientists have suggested that belief in God, which is a common trait found in human societies around the world and throughout history, may be built into the brain's complex electrical circuitry as a Darwinian adaptation to encourage cooperation between individuals. Of course, they're going to come up with an explanation, a Darwinian explanation, but it's just, you know, total nonsense. Like when people speak about evolution and you hear them talking about plants doing this and doing that so that they can, you know, catch animals and, you know, flies and whatever. It's just really preposterous. Anyway, that article was quite long. Actually, I just read a portion of it. Anyway, many of the verses in the Quran that talk about believing in God, very few can be found actually speaking about belief in his existence. When they talk about God, they talk more about, you know, God clarifying things, God guiding the people, sending prophets, you know, causing the destruction of some people, etc., etc. But not talking about, is there a God? Or why should we believe in God? So, for example, whenever Allah speaks about creation, you find him saying, like in Surah Al-Ghashiya, verse 17, أَفَلَا يَنْظُرُونَ إِلَى الْإِبْلِ كَيْفَ خُلِقَتْ. Won't they reflect on how the camels were masterfully created? That's clear proof that there is God. That stands for itself. The camel, built, designed specifically to live on the desert. So, what is used there is design indicates a designer. And as we said before, this was the argument which was used by Greek philosophers from prior to the Christian era. They call it BCE. Plato was the one who argued in this way. Then Aristotle, he argued from the cause and effect chain must come to an end. But this design indicates a designer. The variety and complexity of the intricate systems which constitute the fabric of human existence indicate that there must have been a supreme being who created us. That's the conclusion, the only logical conclusion. Furthermore, since purposeful action is a natural product of human intelligence, reasonable human beings will logically conclude that the supreme intelligent being who created them must have done so for a purpose. Therefore, human beings need to know the purpose for their existence in order to make sense of this life and to do what is ultimately beneficial for them. Throughout the ages, however, there has been a vociferous minority among humans who have denied the existence of God and a purpose of life, because the two are interconnected. Matter, in their opinion, is eternal, and humankind is merely a chance product of accidental combinations of its elements. Consequently, to them, the question, why did God create man, had and still has no answer. For them, the question was more, why did man create God? According to them, there simply is no purpose to existence. However, the vast majority of humankind over the ages have believed and continue to believe in the existence of a supreme being who created this world with a purpose. For them, it was and still is important to know about the Creator and the purpose for which He created human beings. On the other hand, a number of others, as was previously mentioned, claimed and continue to claim that there is no purpose at all. Human beings and human existence is merely a product of chance. Darwin's theory of evolution sufficiently explained our origins without resorting to God to help explain it. There can be no purpose of life. If life evolved from inanimate matter, which only became animate by pure luck, humankind's supposed cousins, the monkeys and apes, are not considered or bothered by questions of existence. So why should human beings be bothered with them? However, this Darwinian approach to explain our existence is a failure. Modern scientists, biologists, etc., no longer really believe in Darwin's theory of evolution as it was presented. They have jumped past that because there were so many flaws. But the mass of people don't know it. It's still in the textbooks, it's still being taught, etc. In the efforts to explain the origin and evolution of life using the Darwinian theory, we find that, in fact, at every step of the way, it fails. Right from the very beginning, the first step of creating the precursors of life from non-living chemicals has not been experimentally replicated. That's stage one. We call that from inorganic to organic. From the gases which presumably surrounded the earth to the simplest of amino acids containing about 10 atoms, which are the most basic of the biochemical universals. Experimentally, Stanley Miller in the US showed in 1953 that by passing an electrical discharge through appropriate gases, surprisingly large amounts of amino acids were formed. The experiments are acknowledged as a major breakthrough in understanding how life got underway. This was the evidence. And then in the explanations, they just move on. But since then, back in 1953, other essential chemicals have been synthesized, more and more of them. However, until today, 5 of the 20 amino acids common in all living beings have resisted human attempts to create them artificially. Can't be done. A Russian biochemist by the name of Alexander Oparin, who died in 1980, first proposed back in 1924 a model of the atmosphere of the primitive Earth, free of oxygen. Oxygen literally eats up any primitive organic chemicals such as amino acids, containing hydrogen and methane, ammonia and water. Life on Earth is shielded from certain death due to ultraviolet cosmic rays by the ozone layer, which covers the earth. It blankets the earth between 15 and 30 miles above the surface. Without oxygen in the atmosphere of the primitive earth, there would have been no ozone layer. Got that? Without oxygen in the atmosphere of the primitive earth, there would have been no ozone layer. And remember, this model which Oparin proposed for the primitive earth was free of oxygen. It has no oxygen in it. This is how it was used to explain the development of the amino acids, etc. But the problem is, without any oxygen in the atmosphere and no ozone layer would be there, the first living organisms would have been wiped out by cosmic rays. And with oxygen present, we need oxygen present to be able to have this ozone layer, the first amino acids could not have been produced. So you're caught. Damned if you do and damned if you don't, as they say. Although imaginative and elaborate solutions have been written to solve this riddle, but for every suggestion, there is an insurmountable objection. You can't have oxygen present in order to produce your first living organisms. And without oxygen present, no ozone layer, the cosmic rays would destroy anything, which any living thing which was produced. So where do you go from there? But of course, when they're telling the story, they just jump from stage to stage and leave out these details. As they say, the devil is in the details. Stage two, assuming that there was, around 4 billion years ago, a sea with a 10% solution of amino acids, this is what the soup that they mix that they're saying it all came from. So we have a sea of 10% solution of amino acids, sugars, phosphates, and so on. Two major steps have to take place simultaneously. An accident may produce one, but two at the same time. Amino acids must link together to form proteins, and other chemicals must join up to make nucleic acids, including the vital DNA. Proteins depend on DNA for their formation, but DNA cannot form without pre-existing proteins. So how? Nor is it relatively easy chemistry to explain this. Proteins are highly complex molecules. Where an amino acid consists of typically 10 atoms, a protein may have thousands. Stage three. So can't get past stage two. But stage three, when they hop, formation of the nucleus. How did you create the nucleus for the cell, where it now is going to control the cell itself? How? How did the nucleus come to be? No explanations. Only fairy tales. Stage four, formation of the cell wall. Okay, after you got your nucleus, you know, containing your key components, and you have your cytoplasm around it, it would be washed away all the time. You need a cell wall to hold it together for that whole cell to function. How? How did the cell wall? Where did it come from? No explanations again. Accidentally. So, you know, when the story is told Hollywood style, all of the fine details and the insurmountable transitions are left out. A cell is formed in the primordial soup. It multiplies and organisms are formed. Then fish evolve, which eventually climb up on the land and climb up into trees. Some fly away as birds, and others get bigger and climb back down and monkeys and human beings were born. Quite a fairy tale. That's reality. And the Darwinian theory has no end of similar flaws. But another major flaw in the theory, which was set forth by Charles Darwin, that he recognized himself way back in 1882, before he died. In his book, On the Origin of Species, he asserted there that all creatures evolved within a chain of coincidences and essentially differentiated from one another as a result of mutations. He didn't use mutations at the time. Later on, scholars added that clarification. So according to the fundamental assertion of the theory, all living things go through minute and coincidental changes. If these coincidental changes help the creature, then it gains advantage over the others. And this is the survival of the fittest story, which in turn is carried on to following generations. This scenario has passed around as a very scientific and convincing one for 140 plus years. However, if we focus on the coincidental changes, Darwin could not provide a comprehensive definition to this concept. He just explained it this way. Due to his lack of genealogical knowledge and knowledge of that time, the evolutionists who followed him put the concept forth as mutation. Mutation is the engine for the coincidental changes. Because mutations are taking place all the time. The cosmic rays, someone that get through whatever, will cause mutations. However, mutation, if we define it, is a product of arbitrary disconnections, dislocations or shifts of the genes in living things. Most importantly, it is the point that should be noted, the point that should be noted, is that not one single mutation in history of science that has been shown to improve the condition of the genetic information of a creature. They did it with the flies. Bunches of the flies were exposed to radiation and all kinds of things, and they mutated. They created all kinds of weirdo flies with legs missing, wings twisted and turned, and all kinds of stuff. Not one single one of them came out with a better leg, bigger wings, whatever. No. Some of them survived it with their mutations, a few, but the vast majority of them were crippled and died. And even the few who survived it, there was no improvement. So, reality. To think that a creature can improve through mutation is the same as shooting at a crowd of people and hoping that the injuries will result in healthier and improved individuals. That is clearly nonsense. As importantly, in contrary to all the scientific data, even if one assumes that certain mutations could actually improve a being's condition, Darwinism still cannot be delivered from inevitable collapse. The reason for this is a concept called irreducible complexity. The implication of this concept is that the majority of systems and organs in living things function as a result of various independent parts working together. Elimination or disabling of even one of those parts would be enough to disable the entire system of the organ. For example, an ear produces or perceives sounds only through a chain reaction of smaller organs which make up the air. The air is not just this outer piece that we see. You know, there are a bunch of components, such as the auditory meatus, the malleus, the incus, the stapes bones, tympanic membrane, cochlea, and fluid sensory cells, vibration sensor extensions of these cells, a network of nerves which connect to the brain, and the hearing center in the brain. They all have to work together without exception. The system could not have developed in segments because none of the segments could possibly function alone by itself. It wouldn't function. The whole system would not function without it, all being in place. Hence, the concept of irreducible complexity demolishes the theory of evolution from its foundations. Scholars have even discussed this with the hair growing from your body. We know we have hairs on our arms and legs and different parts of the body. How to explain just the hair coming about in parts? No way. Everything had to be in place for the hair to be produced. You can't produce a hair in bits and pieces. You won't get a hair. The system and many systems of the body, whether it's sight, it's touch, it's all the systems of the body are like this. So the concept of irreducible complexity demolishes the theory of evolution from its foundations. What is really interesting is the fact that Darwin also worried about these very prospects. He wrote on the Origin of the Species in his book, if the possibility of formation of a complex organ through a series of small changes was ever to be proven, my theory would certainly collapse. He himself saw it. He assumed that everything could be explained through series of small changes. But if, as he said, it was shown, because the knowledge of these systems, the air and how the air works, they didn't have this knowledge that it had all these different parts to it that were needed. So they just thought, okay, there's a hole, goes into your brain, you hear. So making a hole developing, simple. But it's far more complex than that. As he himself said, justifying his claim, however, I could not find any such organ. Back in his time, 1882, when he died, there were no organs that could be seen to be so complex that they couldn't be formed bit by bit gradually. Reality is, of course, that 20th century, in its study of nature, gets down to the minute details in the 21st century and proved that the majority of living structures embody irreducible complexity. Therefore, Darwin's theory has certainly collapsed from these perspectives. I remember when I studied the cell, I like biochemistry. I hope I haven't bored you with too much of this material. But I remember when we looked at, they had identified this body in the cell, cytoplasm around the nucleus. They called it the mitochondria. They didn't know what it was for. They couldn't figure out. They said, oh, it's probably some leftover from evolution, you know, in the evolutionary process with all these, you know, changes taking places, you know, some bits and pieces were just stuck in there, left in the cell. They seem to be in all the cells, but, you know, they obviously were not doing anything. So, like the appendix, the only thing that happens is it goes bad and you want to cut it off, get it out of there before you die. It's a leftover from evolution. However, the mitochondria, 10 years later, 20 years later, became an, you know, a critical part of the cell. The role of the mitochondria in all these different functions of the cell became massive. Before, they said it was nothing. It was just like a piece left over. This is the problem. So how did the mitochondria get into the cell? You know, it's not like the cell went and captured the mitochondria. You know, mitochondria was made outside. No, because the things needed to make the mitochondria in the cell are the same things that are going to be needed outside the cell. And if you are outside of the cell, you don't have the things to make it, then where are you going to get it from? It's a total headache. A headache for the Darwinian scientists. B, if we leave existence of God to the evidences that are sufficient for us, it is important to understand that Allah is above His creation. Allah al-Zahir, most great and glorious, has described Himself in His revealed books and through His prophets in order that human beings may have a better understanding of just who He is. This is why Allah explained about Himself. It wasn't just to write things about Himself so He's known as a name. He did it in order for human beings to know who He is. Since the human mind is limited in its knowledge and scope, it is impossible for it to understand something which has no limits. Therefore, Allah mercifully took it upon Himself to reveal to humankind and the jinn some of His attributes in order that they may not confuse the attributes of created things with those of Allah. When Allah's attributes are confused with those of creation, human beings end up deifying creation, turning creation into gods, multiple gods. They believe in God already anyway. It is this deification of creation which is the essence and foundation of idolatry in all of its forms. In all pagan religions and cults, created beings or objects are falsely endowed by humans with divine attributes and become objects of worship instead of Allah or along with Allah. Among Allah's countless attributes is one which is of paramount importance with regard to the worship of God, as opposed to the worship of His creation. It is the attribute which became confused with the appearance amongst Muslims of the Greek-influenced Mu'tazilite school of philosophical thought, and remains misunderstood among many Muslims until today. This critical attribute is that of al-ulu, transcendence, which in English means highness, that God is above, beyond His creation. It is encompassed in the divine name Al-Zahir, also in Al-Ali and in Al-A'la, all the other names that describe Allah as being above, encompasses this concept. When it is used to describe Allah, this attribute refers to the fact that Allah is above and beyond His creation. He is neither enclosed by the creation, nor is any part of creation above Him in any way. He is not a part of the created world, nor is it a part of Him. In fact, His being is totally distinct and separate from His creation. He is the creator of the universe and its contents. All are part of His creation. However, His attributes function without restriction in His creation. He sees, hears, and knows all. And he's the prime cause of all that happens within the worlds of creation. Nothing happens without his will. Consequently, it may be said that the Islamic concept of Allah in relationship to his creation is essentially dualistic. But in relation to Allah alone, or creation alone, it is strictly unitarian. It is dualistic in the sense that Allah is Allah and creation is creation. Two separate entities, the creator and the created, the infinite and the finite. Neither one is the other, nor are both one. At the same time, the Islamic concept is uncompromisingly unitarian, in the sense that Allah is absolutely one, without parents, offspring, or partner. He is unique in his divinity, and nothing is similar to him. He is the sole source of power in the universe, and everything depends on him. Likewise, it is firmly unitarian vis-a-vis creation, because all of the universe and its contents were created by Allah alone. There was no co-creator. Allah was creating and this other co-creator was creating also. No. All created beings and entities are the product of the same creator. As such, they are constructed from the same elemental substances, the same building blocks of nature. What is the significance of this? The divine name of Zahir, which contains the attribute of transcendence, has special significance to humans with regard to their worship of God. Prior to the arrival of Islam in its final form, human beings had strayed far away from the implications of this noble attribute. Christians claimed that Allah had come to the earth and became flesh and blood in the form of a man, Prophet Jesus, alayhi salam, whom they claim was crucified and died, in spite of the contradictions. The Jews before them also claimed that Allah came down to the earth in the form of a man and lost in a wrestling match with Prophet Yaqub. That's in Genesis 32, verses 24 to 30. That describes the whole process. Sounds funny. Many people who read the Bible say, I never remember reading that. Go back and read. The Persians regarded their kings as gods, endowed with all of Allah's attributes, and worshipped them directly. The Hindus believed that Brahman, the supreme being, was in every place and in everything. So they worship countless idols, human beings, even animals, as personifications of Brahman. In fact, this belief has taken Hindus to the incredible state wherein they actually make pilgrimage to their holy city of Banaras to worship the god Shiva, who is personified as a structure, as an erect male organ, which they endearingly called lingam. You don't believe me? No. Google and find out. The Hindu idea that Brahman is everywhere later became a popular part of Christian belief in their belief system, and eventually found its way into the speculations of Muslim philosophers many generations after the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. When the philosophical books of India, Persia, and Greece were translated during the golden era of the Abbasid Empire, the concept of Allah being everywhere and in everything was introduced into philosophical circles and became a foundational principle in the creed of most Sufi mystical orders. Eventually, it gained sway with a philosophical school known as the Mu'tazila, the rationalists, followers of which occupied key posts in the administration of the Abbasid Caliph, Ma'mun, who ruled from 813 to 832, Christian era or common era. With the blessings of the caliph, they vigorously propagated this belief with the other distortions contained in their school of philosophy. And Inquisition's courts were set up throughout the empire, and many scholars were killed, jailed, and tortured for their opposition to the philosophy of the Mu'tazilites. And it wasn't until Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal, may Allah bless him, publicly stood his ground and defended the belief of the early Muslim scholars and the Sahaba that the tide was eventually turned. He stopped it in its tracks. During the reign of Al-Mutawakkil, who reigned from 847 to 861 of the Christian era or common era, the Mu'tazilite philosophers were removed from sensitive administrative posts in the government, and their philosophy was officially condemned. Although most of their ideas died out in time, that of Allah being everywhere, that is imminent or omnipresent, has remained to this day among the followers of the Ash'arite school of thought. This school was founded by scholars who left the Mu'tazilite philosophy and attempted to refute the Mu'tazilite thought from a philosophical basis. However, they were not able to extract themselves completely as a group, though the founder, Abul Hassan, did get out and called people back to the original understandings. So the ideas continued. Since the greatest sin in God's sight is the worship of others besides him or along with him, and everything besides him is his creation, the principles of Islam are all either directly or indirectly opposed to the worship of Allah's creation. The fundamental tenets of the faith make it very clear that the creator is the creator, and what he has created is created. They are two different entities. Consequently, there are a number of proofs and evidences based on the essential teachings of the Islamic creed that have been used by Orthodox Muslim scholars to establish the fact that Allah is al-Zahir, al-A'la, al-Ali, al-Muta'al, totally separate from and above his creation. I'm going to just now mention a few of the many proofs which scholars have used. The first may be called the natural proof. Human beings, from the Islamic viewpoint, are born with certain natural tendencies, and they are not purely a product of their environment. This fact is based on the Quranic passage in which Allah explained that when he created Adam, he extracted from him all of his descendants and made them bear witness to his unity. This is in Surah Al-A'raf, verse 172. This concept is further emphasized by the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam's statement that every newborn child is born with an inclination to worship Allah, but it is parents or environment, because they represent the environment, they are the ones that make him a Jew, a Magian, or a Christian. Therefore, human beings' natural reaction to the full implications of Allah or God being everywhere may be used as a measure of the accuracy of this belief. If the belief in God is natural, then the natural responses to the implications of God being everywhere should support that belief. The point is that if Allah exists everywhere and is present in everything, it would imply that his essence could be found in filth and filthy places. When confronted with this implication, most people are naturally unable to accept any statement which claims that Allah, the creator of the universe, is present in man's feces and excrements. Or in other words, places not befitting of his majesty. Therefore, it may be concluded that since a human or human being's natural instincts placed in him by Allah reject the claim that Allah is everywhere, it is highly likely that such a claim would be incorrect. Those unwilling to give up the God is everywhere belief, they argue that man's repulsion towards this concept, God being in his feces, is a result of upbringing and conditioning. It's not really a result of natural instincts, but the vast majority of young children raised in communities where they are taught that God is everywhere still automatically reject this concept without any hesitation or contemplation, even though they were previously indoctrinated with the idea that Allah is everywhere. I've tested it out myself in classrooms of children, and the children will give you many other places. They'll say, okay, he's not in the chair. Couldn't be in the chair because I'm sitting on a chair. Means I'm sitting on God. Oh, once others say, couldn't be in our pencils because we're sharpening our pencils and they're falling off and breaking up. And they will tell you no end of places where he couldn't be, because it doesn't make sense. So that's natural inclinations. The prayer itself is proof. According to the rules and regulations governing prayer in Islam, places of worship must be completely free from statues or pictorial representations of God or his creation. And the various positions of worship used in formal prayer, bowing and prostrating, are prohibited from being directed to anyone or anything besides God. If Allah were present everywhere and in everything, it would be perfectly acceptable for people to direct worship towards each other or towards themselves. As the infamous Sufi saint, so-called saint, Ibn Arabi, suggested in some of his writings. Ibn Arabi, who they call al-Sheikh al-Akbar, the greatest sheikh, he said in one of his writings, glory be to He who made all things appear while being their essence. It's all one. Everything is Allah. It would also not be possible to logically convince an idol worshiper or one who worships trees or animals that this method of worship is wrong and that he should only worship the unseen God, Allah, who is alone without partners. The idolater would merely answer that he is not worshiping the object itself, but the part of God which is inside of those objects, which God, who incarnated himself in human or animal form, did. This, in discussing it, do you talk to the average intellectual, educated Hindu who's worshiping an idol, and you ask him, how can you worship this idol? You know, we can break it anytime. Falls down, it breaks. Break it ourselves. So we're not worshiping the idol that you see. It is God who becomes concentrated in the idol at the time of our worship. That's their explanation. However, whoever worships idols, objects, animals, etc., are considered to be disbelievers, even though they believe in God within these creatures, etc., regardless of the rationale which is given. The fact is that such an individual is prostrating before God's creation. Islam came to take man away from worship of man and other created beings and lead them to the worship of the Creator alone. Therefore, the commandments in Islam concerning worship clearly indicate that Allah is not found and is not to be found in created things. He's totally separate from them. From the Quran itself, there are innumerable verses in the Quran that state that Allah is above His creation. They are found in almost every chapter of the Quran, either directly or indirectly. Among the indirect references are those that refer to things rising up to God, or ascending up to Him, or descending from Him. For example, in Surah Ikhlas, Allah calls Himself As-Samad, which according to grammarians is the being to which all things rise. Such references are sometimes literal, as well as in the case of angels, and sometimes they are metaphorical. In Surah Al-Ma'arij, Allah says there, the angels and the spirit, that's Angel Gabriel, ascend up to Him in a day whose length is like 50,000 years. But sometimes these references are spiritual, as in the case of prayer and dhikr, about which Allah said, إِلَيْهِ يَصْعَدُ الْكَلِمُ الطَّيِّبُ. Every good saying goes up to Him. An example of descent from God can be found in the verse, Surah An-Nahl, verse 102. Say, the Holy Spirit has brought it, that is the revelation, down from your Lord in truth, in order to strengthen those who believe and as a guide and glad tidings to the Muslims. Direct references can be found in both the divine names of Allah as well as in His explicit statements. For example, Allah calls Himself by the names Al-Ali and Al-A'la, which you mentioned before. Both of them mean the highest, above which there is nothing. He also explicitly referred to Himself as being above His servants, saying, وَهُوَ الْقَاهِرُ فَوْقَ عِبَادِي. Surah Al-An'am, verse 18. He is the Qahir, the irresistible, above His creatures. He also described His worshippers as those who يَخَافُونَ رَبَّهُمْ مِنْ فَوْقِهِمْ. They fear their Lord who is above them. Therefore, the Quran itself clearly points out for those who contemplate its meanings that Allah is high above His creation and not within it or surrounded by it in any way. You can also find evidences in the hadith, evidences which are literal and evidences which are, you could say, non-literal. For example, Abu Huraira quoted the Prophet ﷺ as saying, a group of angels stay with you at night and another group of angels in the daytime stay with you. And both groups gather at the time of Asr in the evening and Fajr for the dawn prayers. Then those angels who have stayed with you overnight ascend and Allah asks them about you, though He already knows all about you. And so on and so forth. This is a reference specifically to the angels ascending up to Allah. Included among these indirect references are those which refer to Allah being above His throne, which is itself above all creation. Abu Huraira, he quoted the Prophet ﷺ as saying, when Allah completed creation, He wrote a book which He kept with Himself above His throne. Written in it, verily My mercy will precede My anger. An example of direct reference can be seen in the narration about Prophet Muhammad's wife, Zainab bint Jahsh, who used to boast to his other wives that they and their families gave them away in marriage to the Prophet ﷺ, while Allah from above the seven heavens gave her away in marriage. This is in reference to the fact that Allah mentioned about Prophet ﷺ marrying Zainab, who was previously married to his adopted son. And this was something which was not acceptable in ancient Meccan society, pagan Meccan society. So taboo was being broken. So Allah mentions it, though Prophet Muhammad was reluctant, and he went ahead and married her after they were divorced. That is, his son, adopted son Zayd and Zainab. There's another hadith, however, which is so crystal clear, it leaves no room for any doubt. One of the Prophet's leading companions, Muawiyah ibn al-Hakam, said, I had a servant girl who used to tend to my sheep in the area of Mount Uhud, near a place called Jawariya. One day I came to check on the sheep, only to find that a wolf had made off with one of the sheep from her flock. Since I am prone to regrettable acts, like the rest of Adam's descendants, I gave her face a terrible slap. That's the servant girl, the slave girl. Of course, once he did that, he realized he had done a grave error, because the Prophet ﷺ forbade hitting slaves, and also hitting in the face in particular. He forbade it. So the Prophet, so Muawiyah ibn al-Hakam went to the Prophet ﷺ, told him the story of what happened, and sought a way of gaining forgiveness from Allah for it. So he asked the Prophet ﷺ, can I free her? Just free her and end this? Allah will forgive me? The Prophet ﷺ said, bring her to me. When he brought her, the Prophet ﷺ asked her, where is Allah? Ayn Allah? She replied, Fis sama, above the sky. Then he asked her, Waman ana, and who am I? And she replied, you are the messenger of Allah. He turned to Muawiyah ibn al-Hakam and said, free her, i'tiqha, fa innaha mu'mina, for she is a true believer. So when testing the faith of others, the logical question to ask would be, do you believe in Allah? The Prophet ﷺ didn't ask that question. Why? Because most people at that time believed in Allah. As the Quran said in many places, لَإِن سَأَلْتَهُمْ مَنْ خَلَقَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ وَسَخَّرَ الشَّمْسَ وَالْقَمَرِ لَيَقُولُنَّ اللَّهِ. If you ask them who created the heavens and the earth and controls the sun and the moon, they will certainly say Allah. Surah Al-Ankabut, verse 61. Because the pagan Meccans of that time believed that Allah was somehow present in their idols and thereby a part of creation. The Prophet ﷺ wanted to determine if her belief was confused and paganistic like the other Meccans, or whether her belief was clearly Unitarian and according to the divine teachings of Islam. Hence he asked her the question which would determine whether she knew that Allah was not a part of his creation, or whether she believed that God could be worshipped in his creation. Her answer that he was above the heavens was considered to be proof that she was a true Muslim. And it was the only valid answer to the question, where is Allah? Because the Prophet ﷺ judged that she was a true believer on that basis. Obviously, Allah is not everywhere, as some Muslims believe even until today. That's the clear evidence. And that is found in Sahih Muslim. This is not like in some of the obscure books that maybe you find difficulty finding it. No, it's in Sahih Muslim. Subhanallah. If you have doubt, you can go to volume 1, page 271 to 272, hadith number 1094 in the English translation. And you'll find it there. Also, the consensus of early scholars. Their statements confirming Allah's transcendence are too numerous to mention. It is sufficient to mention that in the 15th century, a hadith scholar by the name of Al-Dhahabi, well-known giant of hadith, wrote a book called Al-Ulu Lil-Ali Al-Azim, in which he gathered the statements of over 200 major scholars of the past, confirming Allah's transcendency. A good example of such statements can be found by Mutir, in Mutir al-Bukhari's report, that he asked Abu Hanifa his opinion of a person who says he doesn't know whether his Lord is in the heavens or on the earth. Abu Hanifa replied, he has disbelieved because Allah has said, Ar-Rahman ala al-Arsh istawa, the most merciful is established above his throne. Surah Taha, verse 5. And his throne is above the seven heavens. That's Imam Abu Hanifa continued to say. Al-Balakhi then said, what if he said that he is above the throne, but he's not sure whether the throne is in the heavens or the earth? Abu Hanifa replied, he has disbelieved because he has denied that he, Allah, is above the heavens. And whoever denies that he is above the heavens has disbelieved. This is the Quran. Though many who follow the Hanafi school of law today claim that Allah is everywhere. When I first became a Muslim, I was given a book written in India, Pakistan, called Basics of Islam or something like this. In it was a catechism of belief. Question, answer, question, answer, question, answer. First question, who is your Lord? Who is your God? Answer, Allah. Second question, where is Allah? Answer, everywhere. I read it, accepted it, and carried on. It wasn't until I was studying in Medina, in university, when we're studying the concepts of Tawheed, Asma al-Sifat, etc., that it became clear that that teaching, and that's some 3-4 years later, that teaching was false. And the incident in which Abu Hanifa's main student, Abu Yusuf, told Bishr al-Marisi to repent when he denied that Allah is above the throne, it is recorded in a number of reliable theological works written during and about that era. So in summary, it can be safely said that according to Islam and its key principle of Tawheed, in relationship to the divine names Al-Dhahir, Al-A'la, Al-Ali, Al-Muta'al, etc., which express Allah's transcendence, Allah is completely separate from his creation. Creation neither surrounds him nor is above him in any way. He, Allah, is above all things. This is the classical conception of Allah according to the sources of Islam. It is very simple and firm and leaves no room for the type of misconceptions which often lead to the worship of creation. This view, however, does not deny that Allah's attributes operate throughout his creation. Nothing escapes his sight, as he is Al-Basir. Nothing escapes his knowledge, as he is Al-Alim. Nothing escapes his power, as he is Al-Aziz, and so on and so forth. So, regarding all of Allah's names, which contain attributes, they are in operation throughout the creation. But just as it was considered a major advancement in technology to be able to sit in the comfort of our homes and watch events taking place halfway around the world, Allah sees, hears, and knows what happens in the universe without having to be inside it. Before, we couldn't see, hear, and know what's going on in Iraq or amongst the Rohingyas or the Uyghurs or wherever in Palestine, etc. We couldn't unless we were there, somebody brought the news from there or whatever. Then with television, we are now able. And we see that as technology improvement. So Ibn Abbas was reported to have said, in Allah's hand, the seven heavens, the seven earths and their contents, as well as what is between them, is like a mustard seed in one of our hands. So just as remote control TV was considered a great technological improvement over manual control, we had to go and press all the buttons. Allah's power operates unhindered within the smallest elements of creation without Him having to be present. Without Him having to be present in the spot, in the place, etc., in order to control what's going on. In fact, the concept that Allah is within His creation is really a form of shirk in Tawheed al-Asma wa Sifat, whereby Allah is given some of our human weaknesses. It is humankind and the jinn who have to be present in the world for them to see and hear and know and effect changes, etc., in it. Allah's knowledge and power, on the other hand, has no bounds. Even humankind's thoughts are totally exposed to Allah. Likewise, the emotional workings of the human heart is subject to Allah's control, which is why the Prophet ﷺ often used to say and pray, according to what Salama said when she was asked, which is the supplication that the Prophet ﷺ used to make most frequently. She replied, and he's talking about most frequently in her home. Salama is one of his wives. She replied, he most frequently supplicated, saying, Ya muqallib al-qulub, thabbit qalbi ala dinik. O controller of the hearts, make my heart steadfast in your religion. Barakallahu fikum. Salaamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. We have now come to an end, or to the end, of part one of session 54A. Part two will follow shortly in the days to come, Allah willing. In it, we will, inshallah, cover the third part of the first principle, along with the remaining three principles for adopting and applying the beautiful names of Allah, as proposed by the Andalusian scholar of the 12th century, Imam Ibn Battal. Our dua using the divine name of Zahir will be made at the end of part two, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. We'll now shift to the third portion of our program, which is answering questions and answering your questions. Though today I will have to leave early. I will only take a few because we had a late start and that has affected our time frame here, and I'm fasting. And the fast has come to an end. First question, Razak questions, are the jinn and aliens the same? Allah knows best. They might be. Somebody else asks, saying, oh, this is Tawfiq from Ghana. Please recommend for me whether to start with Arabic language or Islamic studies first in your IOU. It depends. You can start with either. If you start with Islamic studies, you're going to get Arabic anyway. You must study Arabic throughout the 4 years of study in the IOU, Bachelors of Arts in Islamic Studies. However, that level of Arabic that you reach at the end, because you're only studying it, you know, as a subject, one subject each semester, is not the same as studying Arabic complete or even intensive Arabic. We have an intensive Arabic course, two-year course, which you could take simultaneously along with your BAIS program, if you wanted to. Bimish Durrani asks, Isha prayer, can we read 4 fard and 3 witr? What in total do we have to pray in Isha prayer? There's no have to pray. What the total you have to pray for Isha is 4 rak'at. I know you've been told all these stories. You got 23 rak'at and all kinds of things. And I was very shocked when I first heard that, you know, as a teacher in school from some of my students from the Indian subcontinent, that these big numbers were being, no, it's when I told them it's farb, Zohar is only 4 rak'at. No, but we heard that it was like 13 or 15 or, I said, no, it's just 4. Asr is 4. Fajr is 2. Maghrib is 3. Isha is 4. Just 4 units of prayer. There are recommended additional prayers that one may do. You know, the sunnah. Sunnah before and sunnah afterwards, etc. These are all recommended. You don't have to do them. How can you trust Sigmund Freud's theories and not Islam's practical way of life? Me? So you're asking how can you, meaning how can people? I guess because I don't trust Sigmund Freud's theories. It's total nonsense. Anyway, we're going to stop the questions here so I can go and break my fast. Barakallahu fikum. Subhanakallahumma wa bihamdika. Ashhadu an la ilaha illa ant. Astaghfiruka wa natubu ilayk.